The hour of 10:30 having arrived, I'm going to call to order the Higher Education Finance and Policy Committee. Representative Wolgamoth, I know you are in fine fiddle today, so you have a motion for us?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I would like to move the minutes from our committee hearing that was held on
March 21st, 2024.
Representative Wolgamoth moves the minutes of March 21st. Is there any discussion? Seeing no discussion, all those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. The minutes are approved. Thank you, Representative Wolgamoth. Members, today we have a House file. I can't even believe I'm saying the number, 5,299, which is the governor's higher education budget bill. This will be our vehicle bill for some of the amendments that were offered on the House floor. Obviously, those are not part of the governor's budget bill, but we will have another hearing when we'll have this bill up before us. So if you need to offer those amendments, we will. So with that, welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Chair. And for the record, my name is Nikki Oliver. I'm the Director of Government Relations and Community Engagement for the Minnesota Office of Higher Education. So I will be presenting this very lengthy budget bill of ours. So the first thing that this bill is doing is creating a new fee for our licensing and registration department to address increased costs resulting from institutions that require multiple revisions that exceed the normal administrative costs of processing the institution's applications, and to permit a pathway for institutions to continue their application without division staff denying the application and forcing institutions to reapply for authorization with a full application fee, which could range from $2,250 to almost $5,000, I believe. So. Any questions regarding that fee?
Director Oliver, why don't you just walk us through this rather lengthy bill, and then we'll have questions after.
All right. So that is pretty much what's happening in this first in these first few sections. They're adding that language about fees and when that fee would apply for which types of institutions. This would impact approximately 35 institutions. The second change is related to the ALS research grant. The agency was provided $20 million for fiscal year 23. That is, I believe, available until fiscal year 2026 to run a competitive grant for ALS research. Initial request for proposals was issued in September of 2022. The agency collaborated with the American Institute of Biological Sciences to conduct a thorough review of 28 proposals that we received. After the review, only five awards were selected, for, totaling about $4.3 million in grants. This represents a 17% success rate, which is comparable to the 10 to 15% success rate that has been reported by some national funding agencies like NIH, Department of Defense, and American Cancer Society. So what this bill is doing is extending the time in which we have these funds to be able to do more grant competitions, and also is explicit in giving us authority to work with organizations such as the ALS Association or Never Surrender to help us in issuing out these grants. That is the bill.
Questions, members? Representative Rare.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So on the first part, since it's only a two-part bill, how many occurrences of excessive revision did you have until you said, well, we need to just address this?
Director Oliver.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative O'Neill, I do have someone in the audience that could probably answer that question. Andrew Wald, he oversees our licensing and registration department. Unfortunately, our manager of licensing and registration is unavailable, but hopefully he can potentially answer that question for you.
Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Andrew Wald. I'm General Counsel and Director of Compliance at the Office of Higher Education. Representative Rarick, I don't have an exact number for you. I can check with our manager of the division and get back to you on that if you like. I know that this is this increases the capacity, or this increases the workload in an already strained division when we have to go back and forth with any particular institution, whether it's a registered or licensed institution, you know, sometimes up to 20 times to get them to fix clerical errors, you know, sometimes program errors in their brochures or other things. And when we're looking at the number of licenses and registrations that we have to process in a three-person division currently, and we have that level of hand-holding that is necessary for some you know, new programs or institutions, the hope here is that people can get their ducks in a row before it gets to us, or at least within that first or second or third provision before any additional fee would kick in.
Representative Breyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So how many do you license in a year, approximately?
Dr. Wold.
I also don't have that number off the top of my head. I apologize.
Representative Work, we probably will have all that information when we come back and put the mm-hmm. budget bill together. So they can start a list. Representative Rare.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It just helps get us into kind of the context of, I would imagine it's quite frustrating. It just, I just wanted a little bit more context as to how frustrating, what kind of, you know, was it one or two, or was it like 100, or, you know, just what kind of scope we're talking about. On to the second part of the bill. So you said you had 28 applications and 5 awards. Can you let us know just maybe some examples of why an application was not selected?
Director Oliver.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So Representative O'Neill, so the panelists cited that the lack of outcome impact, personal expertise, scientific rigor, and sufficient methodological information as weaknesses in proposals that they reviewed, and for the reasoning for the low selection.
Representative Rarick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So were these applications coming from other higher education institutions, or just help, can you let us know where these applications were coming from, like who is applying?
Director Oliver.
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Neill. So majority of the applications did come from the University of Minnesota and the Mayo Clinic, and those are actually the 5 awarded recipients are the University of Minnesota and Mayo Clinic. I believe there were a few others, but there's very specific language too in who we can award these grants to. But I can get you a full list of the applicants as a follow-up.
Representative Rarick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that's all my questions since it's such a small bill.
Any other questions? Representative Cleburne.
Thank you, and Director Oliver. So I'm going to ask a little forgiveness of my ignorance on this topic, but with the private career colleges that are listed in here and the fees, I'm just trying to think of a concrete example of the private career college that would pay for this. For example, I was looking at some new private career colleges that are starting in like Chicago to address needs that Illinois might have for physicians assistants or dental hygienists or things like that. Would that be the types of educational institutions that this would apply to?
Director Oliver.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I will let Andrew answer that question. I do want to emphasize again that we anticipate approximately 35 institutions between the Minnesota Private and Out-of-School Public Post-Secondary Education Act and Private Career School Acts, yeah. Specifically 10 that are registered institutions under a certain account, and then 25 that are licensed institutions that will be impacted. But to your question, I will turn it over to Andrew.
Director Wald.
Representative Cleburne, Mr. Chair. Yes, I think that those would qualify. There are a number of criteria that are listed in the statute as to what maybe exempt institutions, but generally if it is a career private career school and they are, whether it's career training or a nursing program or something like that, they would be subject to this statute.
Representative Cleburne.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The reason I ask is, you know, when you first look at these fees, they seem a little high, right, if it's filling a need that we have. But some of these institutions that are opening in other states and then would come into our state or want to come into our state are really big moneyed institutions. And so I was just wondering if the financial viability of that institution is looked at when these fees are being set.
Director Bolton.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cleveland. So I think that that is a definite concern. You know, if you're looking at sort of the mom and pop shop taxidermy school versus,
right.
you know, like this larger institution from out of state coming in,
right.
You know, what assets are available.
Right.
And this division that consists of three people
right.
doing all of the work for all of the registered and all of the licensed schools in the state,
right.
Going back and forth, you know, sometimes 10, 20 times, you know, it's a capacity issue. It's also a funding issue. I mean,
right.
like this is a, and I'm not the CFO. I don't have all of the funding strings in
right.
my head. But, you know, it's not a general appropriation that funds this division.
Right.
This division is funded on fees, and it's been on a downward slope for some time. And I think that you can expect an ask next year in a budget year to make some changes to this so that we can better allocate resources to this division to get things flowing more smoothly.
Mm-hmm.
But at this point, you know, and if that were the case, then maybe it could be a sliding fee scale or, you know, something along those lines. I don't know. That's something that we would have to talk about. But, you know, the fees are not low, and the operations costs for starting a business like that are not low. I mean, this is something that people who are planning this sort of business just need to wrap into it right now.
Representative Cleaver.
And to you, Mr. Chair, I would say, you know, if it is a small taxidermy school, I can understand that it would be a definite hardship for them to come up with these kinds of fees. But with some of these larger institutions that are well-honed machines that are really driven by profit, I think we need to think about whether or not these fees truly represent the oversight that our state would have to do to have them in our state and to make sure that they remain good entities for our state. Thank you.
Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Oliver. Nice to see you. So you mentioned that you might have a budget request next year instead of this fee structure. So I just wondered, I know we've met about a situation with a constituent in my district where they had done everything right and you're just short-staffed and no one got back to them for almost a year and they waited on getting their program launched. And it wasn't because their application wasn't correct or needed handholding. It was just you didn't have staff in time. And so I'm grateful we were able to resolve that, but it seems to me that what you really need is another FTE or maybe two. And so I would just like your comments on why are we setting up this structure? It sounds honestly like the applications are incredibly complex if people need 20 and 30 revisions. And that's not unusual. So maybe we should be having a broader discussion about simplifying the process for the applicants and then adding an FTE to your division. That seems much more efficient than kind of cobbling together all these registration fees and different categories for different people. It feels like we're layering on complexity for you and for the applicants rather than creating efficiency. So I would just love your thoughts on why we're doing this now in a non-budget year if we're going to come back with something else completely different next year.
Director Wald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Robbins, I think that this is a Band-Aid solution. This is a temporary solution that we're hoping to stem the flow of these revisions that are necessary. And 20 to 30 is not, you know, typical. Sometimes it can be 6 or 10 or just a back and forth. And I don't know, I don't have the number of institutions that need the extensive handholding of, you know, 20 to 30 times, but I know that they exist. That said, I don't disagree with you that we need another full-time employee or two in the division. You know, over the last year, we've undergone a consulting process that gauged the workflow and the capacity within the division. We have hired two contractors to help with this work. None of that has met the expectations that we had hoped for at this point. And I've recently submitted a proposal or a position request to our HR department to add another temporary full-time staff because we just don't have the budget right now for permanent full-time staff.
Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Oliver. So I would submit to you as you think about the budget year next year that maybe you would come up with a realistic request of what you need. I understand the challenges you had with some of the contract employees, but since they were contract, and maybe it's not too late, you can change those out and get someone who serves your purposes better, hopefully, to stem the tide rather than, I just think this is unnecessarily complicating the process and is not driving to the solution you really want or need. So I would submit, Mr. Chair, that perhaps there's a different way to structure this as we look at the finance bill that would be more in line with where they want to go next year. Thank you.
Director Oliver.
Mr. Chair, I also want to state, thank you, Representative Robbins, that also in our policy bill, we have a few updates there that also are meant to mitigate some of the capacity issues within that department and also allow for institutions to move forward, like with additional provisional licenses and things of that nature. So there's a combination of things we're trying, and like Andrew mentioned, we do agree with you that an FTE, it was just, this is a supplemental budget year. We did propose that request up. It was not one that was taken, so like this is a part of a bigger ask. So for an actual budget year. So thank you.
And Representative Robbins.
Director Wald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Robbins, just to address one of the concerns as well, as far as this complicating things, I think that this is what will allow the institutions that need this extra handholding to proceed. Otherwise, it may just end up being, you know, you get to the 4 to 6 revisions and requests for clarification and that sort of thing. If we have that level of handholding that's necessary, the application will just be denied. And then they would have to get their ducks in a row and have to reapply, which would end up costing more. So this is a patch. It is. Grant, it's a patch. But the alternative would be that if there is this level of care needed to get an institution across the line, then we're just going to deny it and tell them to come back when they have it ready.
So, Representative Robbins. Okay. No more questions, but we do have one person that wishes to testify. So if she wants to come forward. Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. For the record, my name is Sarah Sanchez, and I am the Managing Director of Advocacy with the ALS Association. At any given time, more than 600 Minnesotans are living with ALS, 2 diagnosed and then 2 additional dying every week. It is a fatal, progressive, neurodegenerative disease with no known cure, and it robs a person of their ability to eat, walk, talk, and eventually breathe. Despite significant progress in understanding ALS over the past few decades, breakthrough treatments remain elusive, and people living with ALS urgently need more effective treatments than what is available today. Investment in research stimulates drug discovery and helps to increase clinical trial access and efficacy. It assists in developing new treatment approaches that optimize the use of telehealth and assistive technologies. And as we gain greater understanding of the underlying factors that lead to the development of ALS, research will allow us to leverage genetic testing and counseling to prevent it. The David J. Tomasoni ALS Research Grant Program, named after the late Minnesota Senator, provides that funding for research, contributing to the prevention and functional improvement curative efforts for people with the disease. As you've heard, to date, the research grant has awarded just over $4 million to 5 grantees, with research areas including brain and cervical cord imaging as a biomarker, identification of protected factors, and a biorepository to support ALS research in Minnesota. People living with ALS and their families deserve hope, and by continuing the commitment to this ALS research, we can improve quality of life, find a cure, prevent, delay harms, and ultimately save lives. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I appreciate your time.
Thank you. Any questions, members? Seeing no more questions, Director Oliver, you want to sum up, and or have you summed up?
I think it's summed up.
All right. members, here's the plan. Tuesday, we're going to hear a couple of bills we may need to put into the budget bill in one way or another. Mm-hmm. And then Thursday, we will put the budget bill together. So that's the plan for next week. And with that, meeting is adjourned. Thank you.